My name is Rayford Story. I've been a hobbyist in 3D printing for about 8 months now. I've learned quite a lot and thought it'd be cool to talk about it here. The list up there is slightly modified. We've got Blake Swanson still here. He's our IP lawyer in perspective, one I'm actually kind of interested in hearing. Let's see.
Justin's
down here at the end of the table. Sorry. I actually invited him just a couple days ago because he has one of the newest additions to the market, which I'll kind of show you and talk about as a bit as well. And then Buddy is here with me as well. He's been kind of working and tinkering with this stuff for a while. So we'll go ahead and get started. If you have questions as we go, feel free to ask as you go. There's a microphone in the back. He can kind of walk it to you so everybody can hear. But don't feel afraid to raise your hand during the talk and all. So we'll start out with kind of like what is rapid prototyping. It's a process in which is commonly used in engineering of taking a 3D model, converting it to, you know, first modeling it in some sort of piece of software, then converting it into machine code, commonly referred to as G-code, which is the code that would run some kind of CNC machine or a 3D printer. The primary difference from CNC and 3D printing is that CNC it's a loose term, but it's usually a reductive technology, right? You take a block of aluminum or a block of wood and you trim it down to, you know, something else, you know. It's typically been cheaper just to get a block of things like that. 3D printing has been around for, you know, about what, 10 or 15 years?
Probably more than that.
Probably longer than that now, but I mean it's always been incredibly expensive, whereas CNC, the technology is cheaper to get into yourself, and the do-it-yourself CNC group has been around for quite a while, but 3D printing is just coming into light into the do-it-yourself community in the last couple of years. So you'd upload your G-code to, you know, whatever machine's going to cut down for you, and then it creates a three-dimensional representation of the model that you created. So it's something that's just commonly used in engineering, because if they're designing, you know, some new robot or some kind of, you know, mechanical design, it's best to like model it quickly, have it done within a couple hours, you know, test it out, and then make adjustments. You know, you don't have to send it off to some big, you know, facility, machine shop, something like that. I mean, sometimes you still need things machined, but that's just the general idea of rapid prototyping. It's going from idea to model to like printed, you know, all in one quick set of hours. So there's been a commercial market for this for some time. Z Corp is one of the most well-known printers. I've got a demo video of one of their printers I can show you here. This is
there you go.
Yeah, this is an example. Oh, wow. Okay. That's a new one. These are some examples.
That's from Thingiverse.
Oh, is it? So this is a quick example of a Z Corp printer printing. You can watch it here. Now what it's doing, it's actually laying down a layer of powder each time. There's a very good reason for that in this design. It's because the powder acts as a support material. This printer that you see here, I don't know, what would you say, buddy? That thing costs, what, like $30,000?
Those machines start about $40,000.
About $40,000
today.
So, I mean, if you're in the industry and you can afford that, that's awesome, and you can make these cool. You know, this is a good example. It's a Porsche 3D printer, and we've got a bust of a model here as well. The accuracy of this is incredible. If you want to come up here afterwards and check it out, you can even read California on the license plate, like on this. And the only downside to this method of printing is that this is kind of non-functional. If I was to drop this from up here, it'd probably break in half. It literally is just a powder with a binding agent that goes into it, solidifies it up, makes it a little more solid, so it's kind of like a clay. So it's even kind of like rubbing off of my fingers a little bit right now. But exactly. That's what people usually do, is they'd make a mold to cast like a plastic or, you know, injection molding, that kind of thing. It's very good for that. The other big downside, not only is the printer about $40,000, but the powder is incredibly expensive. It's like HP, they make their money on consumables, not just on the printer, right? So, and there's, You, do you want to talk a little bit about that real quick?
Yeah, so...
Let me pull my mic cord out over here. There we go.
All right, so these powders, I actually bought a bucket of powder direct from the manufacturer. It's a 5-gallon bucket like you'd buy at Home Depot, and it cost me $700. I also bought a gallon of binder, which cost me $400. And the print heads are where they really get you. My printer, the print heads, cost $160 a pop. And they last about a week. So, but we're hackers.
But aren't the print heads easily...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That powder is mostly plaster. That binder is mostly glycerin. And that print head is an HP print cartridge that they cut in half and glue a tube down. So guess what we figured out how to do?
Well, but, I mean, you know how much HP charges for cartridges,
yeah.
So there can't be too much margin there.
Actually, it's a Canon cartridge. The new ones use HP. Mine's Canon.
Okay. Very cool.
This technology, it burns out the print cartridges very quickly because these cartridges are designed to put out ink, not basically glue. Yeah. So those are the expenses of the commercial machines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one that's coming up in price right now is Objet. I've got another demo video here of one of theirs.
Those are really nice.
Flashes. Yeah. These actually lay down a whole layer at a time, and I don't know much about how they do this. I imagine they employ some pretty proprietary technology to do so. One of the interesting things before the video starts is this particular printer got a lot of press because Iron Man 2, most of the costuming was printed. And so this also applies to Dragon Con. It's becoming big in the costume market because most of the suit pieces were actually printed and then assembled on one of these printers. Printed, painted, assembled. So they didn't actually have to like machine them down or custom mold them. They just designed them in 3D, you know, and then printed it out, make a modification, print it again if they have to or something like that.
And they actually started with a scan of the actor's body so they can print this thing and it's dimensionally accurate. They can print it to fit on his hand perfectly, yeah. And it does.
So this is just a quick little demo video. I think this might have been one of the costume parts that they're printing here, but you'll see it just lays down this whole layer at a time there, and then goes over.
I think these are the UV cure resin, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Again, I if it's the way that it's laying this down, I have to assume that there's quite a big market for consumables here. This is not like a standard kind of plastic that it's printing, or it doesn't probably come in a standard, you know, configuration that you could get from like McMaster Car or something.
Yeah.
We fast forward a little bit. You can see kind of. And that's the part that they made there.
Yeah, who needs to mold when you can just print?
Right? Well, it takes a little longer. Right?
So. And it's more expensive.
Yeah.
For now.
Exactly. So that's an example of kind of the cutting edge of you know, commercial 3D printing and where they're at right now. But the rest of this talk will be more about like the do-it-yourself. Again, all the software they use and the hardware, most of these companies write their own proprietary software for taking the models and slicing it into machine code for their printer, because in most cases their printers use, you know, proprietary machine code as well.
Actually,
so
that is technically a proprietary machine. The
yeah.
Up. Do you want to talk about the Up?
Well, yeah, we'll get to that.
Got it later.
We'll
okay.
Get, yeah. So, do-it-yourself 3D printing is a movement that started about, you know, 2 or 3 years ago now. It was really kind of, it got attention from the RepRap organization, which is this group that was founded with the idea of a printer that should be able to print itself, and that's what this one is over here. In the middle, all those black plastic parts that you see there are actually printed, and so the machine can reproduce, I think, about 60 to 65% of its components. And there's a lot of work being done to, you know, increase that percentage so that, you know, you can make it. The idea basically is that it's an open source design. It's available online. All the plans are, and that the parts can be sourced easily. All the hardware pretty much came from, like, think MasterCar in this case. There's even parts of a tin can on there. I mean, there's certain things you just can't get away from. It needs stepper motors and it needs some electronics. However, there's a lot of work being done such that it can make its own electrical boards using either milling tools or an etch-resist marker. So you just basically put a Sharpie in it and then put a copper, you know, etch board in there and etch it down. So this has been developed mainly in universities, hackerspaces, and just the do-it-yourself community. It really is a community-driven project. I'll show you a video in a minute kind of outlining the RepRap project, and it's just people all over the world contributing to it. The electronics have been done a lot by some guys in New York, and it really is just an iterative kind of open source project in that aspect. It's very educational too. This was the main appeal to me into getting into this stuff, is I wanted to learn, and this kind of forces you to learn. You have to learn a lot about G-code. You have to learn about, you know, the technology involved and how you go from a model to the end. And with these commercial printers, you really just got to know how to model something, and you plug it in their software, and, you know, in an hour you get, you know, your print job. You don't have to understand all the way to go into all the actual steps. So it's more of an educational project, and like I said, it's iterative and very low cost as well. It's been proven that you can make this Mendel printer right here for about, they've gotten it down to about $600 if you source the parts correctly, which is just, I mean, dirt cheap for what it is and what it can do. So
the MakerBot 750,
yeah,
kit, and, you know, mm-hmm, it doesn't even print as large as the Mendel does.
Exactly, yeah. So I'll be going in depth into the different printers that we have here in a minute.
Well, if they actually get to the point of completely replicating themselves or being able to, you've essentially built the replicator technology from Stargate.
There you go, yeah. I've actually heard that reference. I'm not that familiar with Stargate, but I've heard that reference made before.
For modeling, what are you using for modeling? Something like Linear?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in a second, some of the software that's used. I'm going to kind of go through the software stack and where you, what's involved in the process. So more on the RepRap, like I said, it's self-replicating, open source, and increasingly multifunction. There's a guy here in Atlanta I've been corresponding with. He actually repairs those Z-Corp printers for a living, and he's designing a mill head for it, basically using a motor that he's found, low cost, and a drill bit, because he wants to be able to etch boards, you know, with it, so that it can make its own electronics as well. Basically, it's a CNC frame, so anything you can put in there, you know, you can do it. In the MakerBot, for example, one of the things that they've, an upgrade that you can get for it is a frost struder, which is basically a tube of frosting, and you can, like print cupcakes, you know, like designs onto cupcakes using the frosting and things like that. So it's kind of limitless what you can do. A lot of people, you could put a pen in it, and you can technically draw with it like a regular printer.
I saw a Dremel to turn it into subtractive.
Yeah, exactly. So you can turn it into a mill, you know, and make it a subtractive CNC machine instead of an additive. That's one of the nice things about it being so open. There's also been a project where some guys have taken all of the electronics and made a plasma cutter out of it, basically. They just scaled up the axis on it, you know, adjusted the software to, but using the same exact electronics, they just hooked it up to a plasma cutter in their basement and made a homemade do-it-yourself plasma cutter using. And they've contributed their code back so that, you know, other people can do that. And that's kind of the beauty of it. The other thing, like I said, all the non-printed parts are easily obtainable. There's multiple vendors you can buy these from or from eBay. And the printed parts themselves, people print them and have been selling them on eBay. So, like, if you don't have access to a 3D printer and you want to get started into this, you can actually buy the full kit, you know, online. I think for that Mendel, it's running for about $975 for a complete kit if you wanted it from one person. That's kind of on the expensive end. So the difference with that one is the assembly time is very long. I've put many hours.
It's nuts and bolts.
It's not working yet. Something's in the mail, we'll put it that way. But I mean, if you look at it, it's basically like an erector set on crack, right? Like, it's nothing but threaded rod and nuts and bolts and washers and lots of them. So the complexity is pretty high.
You've got over 1,000 connectors, like, yeah, nuts and bolts that go on there.
Exactly. Like, the parts list is really, really long. So this was the first iteration. This is like the, I guess, big brother, or at this point, of the Mendel there. This was their first design into it. It was called the Darwin. Complexity was very high. There's a lot of rods you can see there. The reliability was not quite as good. They had a lot of things. So they basically built this and realized, learned a lot, I think, in building it, and then moved on to the design that you see here, which is the Mendel. More of the mass of it's printed, less of it's purchased, so they've moved more towards their goal of, you know, making it completely self-replicating. It's more reliable, and they have a really cool three-bearing axis design. It uses three bearings. There's two rods for every axis to keep it true, the way that it rides, and it uses a neat design of three bearings that they kind of engineered themselves. And they also added a stepper to the extruder, which I'll kind of get on, I'll elaborate on a little more. The next model, this is their latest invention. They've just released the plans for this. This is the Huxley. It's much smaller. It's about the print surface, a little bit bigger than the MakerBot here on print area. Obviously cheaper, easier to assemble, and a lot of things like that. So this one is still an active building. It will work as a bootstrap. I mean, it's not in the, because it requires printed parts, it's not, they have one of the steps in their design, like they design their project such that you can do this without, I mean, if you really want to do it all yourself, you can build what's called a rep strap. There's a number of these. Some of them are basically just pipe fitting screwed together. You're still going to have to buy the stepper motors and things like that, but essentially it allows you to print the plastic parts. So the rep strapping process is a whole other aspect that a lot of people get big into, and it's just basically how to make something to print the parts for this that can then print the parts for another one, and so on and so on. So it's, you know, just kind of bootstrapping it all. This one's still in development, but it's been kind of a demand because the one over here is really large, it's really heavy, so they kind of wanted to scale it down, make it cheaper, make something that fits easier onto a desktop or something, you know, and simplify it a bit. Next is the MakerBot, which we have here. This is engineered by a group of guys in Brooklyn that's kind of spun off from NYC Resistor, which is a hackerspace up there, if you're familiar with hackerspaces or that kind of movement at all. It's a complete kit that you can buy for about $750 to $1,000, depending upon all the options you get with it. The engineering was done differently. It uses the same electronics, and they contribute both source code and electronic design back to the RepRap project, but they wanted to design something that was less intensive in terms of build time, and was just kind of, they wanted to be able to sell kits using what they had, and what they had was a laser cutter. So it's designed to be laser cut. All of the components you see, from the case to pretty much everything, has been laser cut, packaged, and then shipped. The build time is a fraction of what the Mendel takes. It's got a smaller build area, but they've also kind of made a lot of advancements in the heated build platforms, which I'll talk about more later as well. And there's actually a much larger community for this. Because you can buy this kit from one place, I mean, that's a lot of people that are trying to get into this. It's still very educational, like the RepRap, but a lot of people that are just getting into it, kind of, it's easier, you know, buy it from one place, get it, build it in a week, and then you're going, right? You know, it's just like buying a Lego kit. Whereas the Mendel, you have to buy from different, you know, people all over the place, compile, and try to build it.
Yeah, we built this in what? It was about 2 days?
It was about 2 days. But
that's because we were missing some parts.
Yeah, and we had about three people working.
Part of the record is about 3 hours from the people who actually made the MakerBot. Like, they can build one in up to three hours. And like,
wow.
That's quick.
Good for them.
Hours.
We could.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a quick question. What was the material used to make the 3D model of this kit?
The 3D model that's in being printed?
Yeah, so being printed.
That's ABS plastic, probably.
ABS plastic, which we have a spool of right here, and we can show you some samples of afterwards. It's basically Lego plastic.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I mean, it's...
You want to pass them around?
Yeah, sure. If you got a strand, you guys can pass it around. Here, we'll also pass around some things that have been printed. We have a whistle here, for example. That's kind of neat.
Please don't blow on it unless you want my germs.
Here we go.
One other quick question. How easy As far as ABS plastic, where can you buy that? Like a Lowe's or Home Depot or something like that?
That's a little trickier. I'm going to get into materials more in depth in a minute. But ABS, right now, it's most commonly purchased through suppliers that specialize in these printers. McMaster does not carry... McMaster car, if anyone's familiar with... Huh? Oh, yeah, you can pass around all those if you want. Yeah. Just as, these are some printed objects you guys can check out. Just drop them back off on the table if you end up with them. Please.
Pass those around, too.
Okay.
This is a commercially printed part by a Stratasys machine to compare, and that ring right there. So that's to compare the do-it-yourself to the professional.
Works differently than the other ones, actually. The Solito printer lays down flat sheets of plastic, like transparency, and then cuts out the shape and then lays another layer on top of it, which is kind of interesting.
Cool. So back to your question about the plastics. They is not an industrial supplier that sells consumer quantity, really, because, I mean, you typically buy it about 5 pounds at a time. Most suppliers online right now that sell plastic in this spool form at about 5 pounds. 5 pounds goes a long way, and it usually costs about $60 for 5 pounds, which is really cheap for consumables, because that goes a long way in terms of plastics. And you're not printing solid parts either. I can talk more about that. The parts that you're seeing are not solid on the inside. They've actually got kind of like a mesh form, because it'd be wasteful to print them solid.
Mine are.
Yeah. Mostly solid.
The powder stuff is solid.
Yeah. But like I said, there's a huge community around this. Their mailing list is insane. If you have like questions or problems, there's usually more people that can answer it, because they're selling so many of these. They keep coming out with new designs. They just came out with a new extruder the other day, if you follow. So if you're looking at getting into this really quickly, and you have a little bit extra money to spend and you don't have as much time, MakerBot's probably the way to go. Because you're going to learn a lot, but you're going to have the convenience of getting all of your parts and all of your stuff in one nice shipment and a really good instruction guide and stuff like that.
At this one point, you can use the MakerBot to print parts for a mantle.
Which is exactly what I did. And that's actually a common theme. I got a MakerBot and then kind of got hooked on this, you know, whole movement, and so... Naturally, I used it to print all those black parts that you see on the Mendel. They all kind of came out of this printer here.
That's actually my plan, too.
Your MakerBot actually... how durable are the parts of MakerBot? I guess ABS plastic, they're relatively durable.
They're incredibly durable. Those ones I'm passing around, you could probably stand on any of them. I mean, they're like Legos.
Well, actually, yeah. I know a lot of people make the armor pieces now out of ABS plastic and do it in the vacuum form. Probably a larger version of this would be a lot more...
Like I said, you can configure it in software. Most parts are not printed solid. If you print solid, I mean, they're just, you'd have to get a saw to even try to cut through it.
The strength also depends on the orientation, like how the pressure is hitting, because like it lays it down in layers. So if you're pressing against the layers, it's very, very strong. But if you're pressing against the layers, like if you've got your layers like this and you're applying force from here and here, then you're going to get less strength from it than you would if you were applying force to the layers one on top of another. Yeah. But it's still very high for both ways.
Question. Other than size, is there a difference to the quality between the two, the MakerBot and the other one?
Not really. I mean, the stepper motors and the design, while they're different, are the same technology. There's a lot of tweaking in both of these to get really good quality, both mainly in software. You have to kind of calibrate the software, fine-tune it. There's a lot of guides on how to do this to get better and better resolution. You'll notice that some of these commercially printed ones come out looking really elegant. You can still tell they're layered, though. Like, it's still evident. If you look at some of the parts that are on the Mendel, it's very obvious they're layered, but that's because I was printing them in a very fast setting, because it does. I don't care what they look like that much.
It's hard to find the layers on those, but...
Yeah, these
even on these, you can see it if you look really closely.
Yeah.
We can pass these around. I don't care if anybody breaks them.
Cool.
So, to give you a point of reference, this thing was actually printed like this. So it was printed sideways, so you can see the layers through here. But it's so accurate that it stands up. So it printed a flat edge vertically.
Another question. Will the time affect the quality of the printed object, and as far as if you take more time, will it like affect the detail and the quality of the item?
Yeah, kind of. If you see one of the pieces, you'll see the layering, and what you really improve upon is getting. You kind of have to test the machine and see its limits. The faster you print, if the machine can handle it without too much vibration, you can actually get thinner layers. So you get a finer, kind of like a higher resolution by doing that. But you also kind of end up pushing the mechanical limits of how what it can handle without too much resonance.
And taking a lot longer to print.
Yeah. Exactly. And the thinner you do the layers, the longer it takes. With the thicker layers, you're just... Because it's essentially squishing layer on top of layer, and when you do it slower, it's actually putting out so much more plastic that the layers are thicker, so it goes through them a little quicker.
With thinner layers, do you get a better strength?
That I don't actually know.
I've done actually a few tests just with the different layer settings on mine, and I found that, thinner layers generally tend
to... Acid and watertight a lot of times.
That's going around was... It's basically treated with acetone because it goes into the post-processing, the Stratasys post-processing box, and they basically just spray it with acetone and then dry it off.
All right. Another question here.
I have a question about the whistle. There's a free-floating ball in there, so how does it... How does...
So there's actually a story behind that whistle. You want to go in it now?
It's kind of neat.
So when we... this MakerBot actually lives at Freeside Atlanta. It's a local hackerspace. If you live in Atlanta, come check us out. There's flyers here. But Rayford, myself, and a couple of other Freeside members threw money in, and we bought this thing. And I had seen a 3D printed whistle from another MakerBot, so I was like, we have to print the whistle. We spent so much time trying to get the whistle
Lots
to print
of failures.
Because we didn't know how to set the machine up and all that. But that's the second whistle we printed. He still has the first one, I hope.
Yeah, it's in my bag, actually.
So the ball actually prints attached to the whistle. It's attached to one side, and you pop it off with a pair of tweezers or a screwdriver when you're done printing it.
Yeah, it's basically like it ends up just being inside, and you kind of just stick a pair of pliers in there and pop it loose. And so it's...
Quick comment on what he was asking earlier. Oftentimes the parts you're making, you have critical surfaces you want flat. If you can square those up to the major surfaces of the Cartesian, right, then you don't get the aliasing, because a lot of the layering is just like aliasing on a monitor. Right, exactly.
For those who don't know what in graphics, if you have anti-aliasing, that's the jaggies along the edge, diagonal edge. Well, the idea of anti-aliasing is to make that look smooth. It's just a visual trick. But when you do that in real physical objects, you still see the jaggy edge. However, if you make it horizontal or vertical, it's on a straight plane, you don't get the jaggies, basically.
Another thing, while we're talking about the whistle, it's worth pointing out this whistle actually kind of pushes the machine to its limits. Because of the issue of overhang. And with the powder-based one models that you see, it's actually putting it into a bed of powder. So the powder itself acts as a support material.
I feel like an archaeologist digging my prints out. You just get a brush, just kind of brush it away. I want to print a set of dinosaur bones.
So that'd actually be pretty cool. Like, can you get a 3D model of, like, a full Tyrannosaurus Rex?
We'll have to see what we can do.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great for, like, a...
I don't think my build area is big enough, though.
We can print them one by one. Well, not a... Not
print the teeth.
Scale model. We'll scale
Who says they weren't 2 inches tall?
That's right.
So, but like I was saying, the issue... they solved that issue of overhang with that printer because it can print... each layer is just where it puts down the binding material. And the rest of the powder is there to kind of support it. So you could print, like, an arch. On this one, you can't print an arch because it's going to get to the top, or you can't print an H, for example, standing up, because it's going to get to the cross section of the H, and there's nothing there below it, and the plastic's just going to fall, into nothing. You'd have to lay the H on its back to print it. And in the case of the whistle, the top surface is actually about as far as you can go. Like, we weren't sure if it would actually droop down in or fall down in, and so it literally just kind of tacks it on and then drags the plastic apart, tacks it on the other side, and as it cools, it kind of pulls it up a little bit. But that's about the biggest gap that you can print over with this printer, as an example.
Could you stop it mid-print and put something in there to support it?
You could.
But then you can't get it back out.
Yeah.
And also, you'd have to, the extruder might hit it. and when it goes to do the next layer, if it goes over that. So
they do support material as well.
Exactly.
Like some people will actually create small bars and support structures to actually support those arches so they can still print them, which they then cut out later. This printer, for instance, automatically inserts support structures, which for the whistle is a pain in the butt, by the way, because it puts a bunch of support structure inside of the whistle. And my whistle sounds like an eagle.
Another thing,
two tones.
And try to remind me, I'll get back to this. I'll show a couple more printers, but there's some other tricks that are being done currently by the RepRap project and support materials that are really cool. So
has anybody ever made a MakerBot or modified a MakerBot or a Mendel to actually use the soluble support stuff that the really expensive machines use?
Not yet.
I saw a wax mod where they had a heated syringe that you filled with wax and used to make support.
There's also talk of doing MakerBots with multiple extruders. So the problem is to do the support structure, first you have to have code to automatically put the support structure in, which doesn't exist right now.
Yeah.
And second, you need to be able to extrude both of them.
It does.
Oh, does Scanford have it now?
No, RepRap software does.
So you have to have basically two extruders. And for this guy, the extruder is the most finicky part of the bot because it's got to melt this plastic at a very high temperature very precisely and get it out onto your printed material. So I can't imagine wanting to maintain two of them right now.
Yeah. Well, the RepRap project actually has, the machine's large enough that you can put two extruders on it. And what they commonly do is they'll use ABS in one and polylactic acid or PLA in another, and I'll get to that plastic in a minute, so not too many questions about that. And what you can use in their software is if you wanted to print something with that, like let's say you want to print the H standing up, you could actually put in two models and it will halfway through its process switch extrusion head and then the other one, and then one is easier to dissolve with acetone than the other, so you basically would dissolve out the support material or break it away or something like that. So they've been focusing most of their code development on that right now is because it's still very buggy as to how to when to switch and how to switch and not run into things. And
but like he said with the whistle, sometimes support material can be a real pain to have. Yeah. So some people are just opposed to it.
Yeah.
And some people say, well, if you want to add it into your model.
Yeah.
So
I'll go ahead and kind of move on to the next one.
Yeah.
Which is his down here. We're fortunate enough to have one of these. They're very hard to come by right now because they're very new. But he was visiting Freeside just a few days ago and had it, and I convinced him to come here and sit on this panel. This is the Up by a company called PP3DP.
Which is actually different from what they put on their bank statements.
Yes.
The bank statements, their world inno. But the website is PP3DP.
Yes.
Did you pay for that with a wire transfer?
Yes.
You're much more brave than I.
Oh my God. I paid for it and immediately was like, I shouldn't have done that.
Basically, someone in China has seen this community emerging and realizing the implications of it and the demand. So they made one that works out of the box. And I've got to say, it works quite well. The engineering in it's really good. I was skeptical, but after seeing it run, I was impressed. If you want to run it, it's quite enough. I can probably talk over it. So if you want to watch one run, he can run this and print something. It's also using ABS plastic. The quality is good. It's using completely proprietary electronics and software, though. Modifications, not much of an issue. And, I mean, it's manufactured, though. The functionality is the same. The extruder appears to be designed in pretty much the same fashion. Everything else is proprietary, and we've had some discussion about the legitimacy of the libraries that convert the 3D model to the machine code, because it's far beyond anything we've seen available open source.
It will print non-manifold meshes. There's an option that you can click to tell it to ignore manifold information, and it'll print the non-manifold mesh for you.
Interesting. So, but like you said, it's right now to obtain one, you have to send a wire transfer to China, and... You know.
They should have PayPal this month, though. They said they were going to have it up like sometime this month, so you should be able to pay for it.
If you want to get into it and you're not much of a do-it-yourselfer, you just want something to print right away, that's probably the way to go.
Yeah, to give you a reference, this machine is a kit. It costs about $750, and that was $1,500?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's going up to $3,000 at the end of the month.
Oh.
So, but that's depends on how much your time's worth to you, I guess. But there's still some yet to be seen about the software. The software is not as extensible as I can tell, but as far as in terms of tweaking how it generates the code. but I'll get into that in a second.
Just
so
waiting for the print head.
It's also Windows only. The advantage of the RepRap and the MakerBot, all their software is written in Java or other open source, in Python, you know, things like that. So it's can be run on OS X, Linux, or Windows, whereas the UP is Windows only. The resolution's really good. They're mass-produced. There's little build time. And there's actually a couple printed parts. The white plastic parts you see on it are, in fact, printed.
That's printed.
So
printed.
It's not completely manufactured.
You
it's got a few
of that, right?
The optical, yeah, that yeah.
was I want to pass there. This around. This is a gear that he printed on yeah. that machine. And you kind of compare that to the MakerBot.
What's the printing surface on the difference between the three?
I think the, what's the 100 millimeters on the MakerBot? Is that about right?
It sounds about right.
140, yeah. I thought.
140 squared. We also have the nuts it'll run into if you...
Yeah.
there's inconveniently these bolts sticking out of the build platform.
Of these, the Mendel has the largest build area. Mm-hmm. If you...
Can I move this easily?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll pop off.
Yeah, okay. Do it without breaking it.
Wouldn't be the first time it's been broken.
So this that you see in my hand behind, let's see, where's that connect? Okay, here we go. This is the build area of the MakerBot. So your X and Y can be no bigger than this, and you have to watch out for those nuts. And then height can go up to about like that, I would guess, before it starts acting up. Because it's ABS plastic, it shrinks as it gets colder, and that limits how high you can build. This is a heated build platform, which tries to keep it warm while you're printing, but even then there's eventually a limit of what you can print before it starts just going haywire.
Yeah.
There have been talk of like adding heated build chambers to kind of counteract that curling.
You can also sit there with a heat gun.
Yeah. So hair dryer.
Yeah, I've seen that done too. So to show you, I'm going to kind of go through some of the basic components, and I'll go through this. These are the components of an extruder. This is the most complicated thing on the MakerBot or any, you know, 3D printer. Basically, it has to run at about 220 degrees Celsius if you're using ABS plastic. And it has to be able to push, drive this rod of plastic through that, down through a nozzle that's anywhere between half a millimeter down to a quarter of a millimeter. And that's the actual nozzle size coming out. The nozzle and, like, tube itself are all machined out of brass. They're pretty easy to reproduce if you know how to use a lathe. Thermal barrier is something that keeps, in this case, the actual body of the extruder is made out of cut like Lexan, which would easily melt if it was in contact with the brass. So there is a thermal barrier, which I have an example of here. This one's made out of a very hard kind of plastic called PEEK. They're also made out of Teflon or even Torlon as well. If you'd like to come up afterwards, you can take a closer look at these. Then this is an example of the nozzle, brass nozzle, and the head as well. Extrusion head just kind of screws off.
I have a question.
Oh.
After the convention over, where is a good place to come see stuff like this?
Oh, Freeside. Did we mention that yet?
Oh, I'm sorry. I must have missed that. And what sort of day of the week would be a good time to come by?
Tuesday.
Tuesday?
Yeah.
Did you say Tuesday? That's a good day? What
Swear,
time
we don't know that girl.
Yeah. Who?
What time exactly would be a good time to stop by?
We happen to have flyers that detail
most
of that right here.
Oh, really? I'd love to get
one
of those.
So this is the intermission plug for Freeside Atlanta. Come by and see us. We're a local nonprofit, basically, that just does stuff like this. It's really
and
cool.
And if you haven't been to their facilities,
you should check it out, Elena. Oh, wait, how do I know her
it's
name?
It's awesome.
Yes. Yeah. We do CNC, electronics, sewing,
welding,
lathe usage, you name it. All kind of really cool stuff that we want to learn and teach others. And it's all of our classes are free unless there's a material cost because we're a nonprofit. We're trying to work with some schools and stuff too. So if you are a teacher or anything, come talk to us afterwards. We'd love to. You know. Anyways, so talking about the extruder again, the heating element that usually heats it up, traditionally they've used nichrome wire, which is what's used in like wire cutters and things, just wire that gets incredibly hot, and a thermistor to measure the temperature and regulate the temperature. The newer extruder designs are all using heat resistors just because they're easier to assemble than nichrome wire. Nichrome wire can be very finicky, but it is cheaper. The thermistor is just monitored by an extruder board, and it uses a loop to monitor the temperature. You can kind of, and then the other like thing that's like, you get some kind of insulation. In this case, it's a fiberglass insulation or tubed insulation, Kapton tape. This stuff's amazing. I'd never used it until this, but it's like completely heat resistant tape.
Developed by NASA.
Yes, look at that. It can deal with like up to like 400 degrees Fahrenheit or Celsius.
I've seen people using that for the heated build. The actual enclosures as well. Mm-hmm. Like they'll build the box out of Kapton.
And then the surface itself, like the actual build surface he was showing you, is covered in a layer of Kapton tape as well.
On the nozzles, the printhead nozzle, do you have to compensate your build based on the expansion and contraction due to the heat and differential between the tip and the backside of the nozzle for expansion and contraction?
It's kind of pressurized because it's driven from the back, and it's the temperature is, it heats up gradually. So there is probably some expansion and contraction as it heats up, but then it maintains the temperature. So as it's printing and extruding, you don't really deal with much temperature flux. It's the thermistor's there to regulate the temperature and keep it as accurate as possible. So. And if you guys want to get a closer look at these, the extruder nodule, like I said, it's the most complicated part, and everything like that. So the next component is the drive system. Oh, one more thing on the extruders. The newest designs all use stepper motors because one of the challenges is how to drive the plastic in there when you need to stop, like the head needs to stop printing. And on the MakerBot, for example, if it does that and then it drags it over to another part, it's going to leave this like whisker. It's going to pull out whatever's left in there. So precisely reversing the motor when you need to stop to keep it from making that whisker or to printing too much, they've actually added a fourth stepper motor to design and geared it such that it gets better control. And you can take a look at that on the Mendel. The MakerBot has a regular motor, non-stepper based extruder. So then the drive system, which is just like your chassis. X, Y, and Z axis. Usually X and Y are always driven by belts with three stepper motors. And then you've got threaded rods that are commonly used to drive the Z axis. In the MakerBot's case, it's got four threaded rods hooked up to this pulley here. And that's actually what makes it go up and down. That axis doesn't get used very much because it literally just, it does a layer, then it goes up. Does a layer, then goes up. So it's not, it only turns as it goes up or down a layer. The Mendel uses two threaded rods to accomplish the same thing, basically. And then you also use ground rods, which are not like the kind that you stick into the ground for your house. They're just the very smooth rod that you'd see in like a typical HP printer or something like that. It's what it uses to guide the axes and keep them true in a direction. There are a lot of idlers and pulleys and things like that. Tension. Electronics, you have motherboards, stepper controllers, an extruder controller, and in the case of the Mendel, end stops. Basically, it can center itself by going all the way to the edge, and it will trigger this switch, and then it knows that it's at the edge, and then it goes back to the middle. The up does the same thing. It has an end stop so that when you watch it, it'll go all the way to the edge when it starts, and then it kind of knows where the center is from there. And a power supply. The MakerBot uses a standard PC power supply. The Mendel can as well. Mendel just needs 12 volts. At about 4 to 6 amps or so. So you can use, laptop power supply if you have one that's strong enough. Question back there?
Has anyone in the RepRap community figured out how to deal with the chicken and the egg problem? Basically, in order to print something, you need to have a surface that is more heat resistant than the thing that you can put onto it. So is there any effort, any, chemical engineers, anyone like that that's trying to figure out, hey, how the heck do I build a surface that I can print one of these almost unprintable things onto that can withstand the heat necessary to print the other parts?
They use a laser cut acrylic, so it's not necessarily going to actually be able to print 100% of itself. Until they figure out how to make threaded rod. I would love to see someone 3D printing threaded rod for a Mendel. Maybe one day. That's
the truth. In the case of both these, the MakerBot by default comes with cut acrylic. One of the things they actually recommend, there are some cheap parts that either laser cut on the Mendel or we cut on a CNC machine, or you can actually cut them by hand if you don't have either of those. It's a little trickier, though. The most common thing and is recommended widely is they lay down a layer of blue painter's tape onto the build surface because it's very coarse on the top, so it'll actually hold the plastic very well. And it doesn't, even when it gets hot, it doesn't leave the adhesion, the sticky residue on the platform itself. So when you peel it off, it's not going to leave behind. It's made not to leave behind any sticky residue, and it's disposable. So once you print on it, you can peel it off, it wears out, and you can just put down another layer. It's available at the hardware store, you know. There is a heated bed design for the Mendel as well. A lot of people still use painter's tape with that. And in the heated bed designs, there are always a layer of aluminum. Like the one that he showed you is actually layered. It's got a layer of aluminum with a heating platform underneath it and Kapton on top of the aluminum for adhesion. So. Questions, right?
I think you just covered that.
Yeah, hey, look at that. And funny enough, the print surface. Here you go. With the heated bed, you don't actually... The last point's kind of interesting. I haven't mentioned it. It's called rafting. I recommend, after this, coming up and taking a look at what the UP is printing. It's printed a raft below it. It's basically kind of an interface layer between the heated platform and the part that it's printing. It gives it something to snap off of. It literally just goes back and forth and prints out a useless layer for to then build the model on top of. It comes out with a cleaner edge on the model. With a heated build platform that's smooth enough, you don't actually have to do this. And a lot of the Mendel parts are printed without a raft, and what ends up happening then is a very perfectly smooth edge because it's just printing, kind of squishing down onto a smooth surface. And rafting is... A lot of people use rafting even with the heated beds. And the heated bed, just to point out, the purpose is to prevent it from curling, because as you layer up ABS especially, the top layers end up being hot as the bottom layers cool. And what happens is the whole part just curls up and peels off the platform. It can eventually run into the head. Like, it'll peel up so bad that the head will run into the part because it's lifting itself up. So heating the bed helps curve that a little bit.
Are the processors used to control these, are they off the shelf like Arduinos or something, or is it something you actually have to build?
Actually, yeah. So I skipped that. I should have mentioned it more in the electronics. In the case of the RepRap electronics, which are on both of these, they are literally using Arduino chips, which is the ATmega 168 in this case. The new version, they've made a new version of the electronics for the Mendel that is, you can laser etch it, or not laser etch it, but etch it with a marker if you want to in the Mendel, or you can order a kit from a guy in Tennessee who almost made it to this conference. He designed a Arduino shield. So if you're familiar with the Arduino, you can buy an Arduino Mega, which is this big, and then you can buy his little kit for like $50, and then you literally just plug it into an Arduino and it ends up as like a block, and that's all of your electronics. It turns out his kit's actually cheaper than these. And I think a full set of those electronics can run about, with the Arduino, runs about $150. Yeah, and the most expensive part of that is $14 a piece. Yeah, and of course the designs are all open source for the hardware as well, so you can get the board, you can etch it yourself, you can order it and assemble it yourself as well. Yeah, actually it was, how much longer do we have, another half hour or so? What is the schedule for? An hour?
Well, 25 minutes.
25 minutes? Okay. I'm going to spend about 5 more minutes talking about stuff like this, and then I want to... there's actually a part on the legal issue that I want to get to. So, the software stack... most software...
part of Illusion. All of them at this point.
Pretty much everything does. STL is a stereolithography format. And then you'd feed that into some slicing software. And this is what actually generates the code. It takes that model and slices it into layers and then generates the actual drive code for the machine. In this case, we're using something called SkyForge. This is SkyForge right here. It is incredibly complex and configurable. Each of these fires up ratios, numbers you can tweak. It's a lot of trial and error in this software. You can use it to multiply. You can print the same part 5 times on one surface, like if it's small enough. For example, there's a group called MakerBlock now that's basically developed open source Legos. And you can print multiple ones on the surface at once. So that's kind of cool. And this is just the software you can spend hours tweaking. And this is where you get the improvement in quality. is in this piece of software and in tweaking it for your machine. So SkyForge, which I'm going to show you, it's completely open source. It's developed mainly as university projects. A lot of people, because it's just math that I don't understand. And that's all I can say. It's still very much in active development. I mean, you can follow the bleeding edge of their builds if you want and get their latest and greatest features. It's not very pretty in terms of a GUI because they're not really focusing on that, I guess.
I read they recently added support structures to SkyForge.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot on the RepRap Foundation folks doing that. There are the commercial options. As we said, we had speculated the slicing done by this is very elegant, so we don't know what library it's using, and we haven't really investigated it. So it's not using SkyForge as far as we can tell. It appears to be using some Windows-based library, or Windows-compiled library, that does a pretty darn good job and might not be completely legal. But and then there's different pieces of software to control the machine itself. These are not that interesting, so I'll kind of skip through that. Print materials, I did want to talk about this real quick since there's a few things. ABS is the Lego plastic. This is a kind of comparison of their qualities and how to find them. What I will be printing on the Mendel is polylactic acid. If you've ever seen the cornstarch-based biodegradable plastic cups, that's polylactic acid. It's made from cornstarch. It's non-toxic. The thing about printing the ABS is I got a condo with a small room that I print in, and if I print something that takes an hour, I don't want to be in that room because I've gotten it'll give you a headache. It's pretty toxic stuff. The fumes are, at least. So the PLA plastic avoids that. It's just cornstarch. Apparently, it has a very sweet smell when it actually kind of
waffles.
Yeah, a lot of people say it smells like waffles. So if you like waffles, that's the way to go. The last one is one that there's been a lot of experimentation in, which is HDPE. It's milk jug plastic. There's some other university students that have made a machine to grind up milk jugs then just extrude it into the filament that goes into this machine. So they want to be able to take milk jugs, you know, throw them in there, cut them up, make the plastic, feed the plastic in the machine.
And print more milk jugs.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, honest to goodness, complete end-to-end at-home recycling is what could happen there. Problem is, that plastic does not print well. We attempted some prints with it. We have some. It's tricky. It curls a lot. It shrinks a lot because as soon as it cools down, it just does not behave. And if you've ever felt a milk jug, it's very malleable. So it's not a rigid plastic. And here we go. So we have with us an intellectual property lawyer. And so I kind of want to start this discussion. One website that has popped up as a result of all of this is called Thingiverse. And I'll show it to you all here. This is basically an open source website. If you have a printer, you're obviously not going to take the time to model everything you need. So this website is kind of like SourceForge for 3D designs and other designs. They're all open source on here, so
that's
intellectual
right
property isn't an issue here, but it poses a lot of it poses a lot of questions.
Oh, nice.
So
the pinball on the right there, the green.
Oh yeah.
That's
matter of fact,
his.
Yeah. He designed this part here. There you go. He's got an iPad pinball.
That's actually a derivative of mine that somebody fixed for me.
Oh. Because
it was failing manifold, but then I found out afterwards I could just print it without manifold, so it didn't matter. But they made one that was nice and manifold that anyone could print.
Oh, nice. Yeah, this site is essential to 3D printing at this point. This community really wouldn't exist to the degree that it does without this website. Because you can take people's parts and then iterate on them, and you can do derivatives, as he said. It's really, this site's been engineered for this type of engineering and design. And, for example, you can make upgrades. This is an upgrade to the Mendel. It's a spool that you can mount on the top of it and things like that. So, but along those lines, so My first question to you would be, what happens if someone, you know, takes a patented design and puts it up there this site?
That would actually be my first worry about something like this, because just because someone throws it up there and says, oh, hey, this is open source and everyone can use it, doesn't mean they have the right to do it. Doesn't mean they're doing anything deliberately wrong. They may have no idea. They may not have gone to, you know, they're not in the patent office. They're not doing searches on all the patents that have ever issued. They may not know that their design is infringing something. before they throw it up there. And anyone who then goes and uses it and makes that design is infringing the patent and is liable to the patent holder for damages. Much as with, you know, someone using a library, we don't necessarily know where it came from. Just because they gave it to you doesn't mean they have the right to do so. And that would honestly be my first concern with something like that.
Which is interesting, though, even though, I mean, like, but just, for example, going to, you know, a patent website or the Google patent search and finding a patent, patents also are kind of exist for disclosure.
Sure.
Of an idea. And taking, is it legal to take that patent, design something at home, like some patent on a gear system or a transmission drive, right? If I then modeled it just using those designs and printed my own for personal use, is that patent infringement?
Yes, as long as the patent is in force. The idea is we give people 20 years of a monopoly in exchange for disclosing their ideas. That is essentially the heart of the patent system. In exchange for contributing these new inventions, these new knowledges to the useful arts, whatever that may be, we give you a limited time in which you are the only one who can practice this invention. Now, after those 20 years, after the patent's expired, then anyone can use that idea.
Right.
So there's no fair use doctrine for patents the way
there's absolutely no fair use doctrine for patents whatsoever.
Patents are kind of like a commercial form of open source almost, because the other option is you can have a trade secret.
Mm-hmm.
And so a patent encourages a company to actually tell everyone how they're doing some complicated thing. And in exchange for that, you then could read that patent, learn how it works, and build on it, and come up with your own patent that they might license back from you in the future.
Right. And the flip side of that, actually, what I was thinking about when you were mentioning kind of going back and re-engineering the powder formula,
right.
They may keep their own powder formula a trade secret instead of a patented formula, in which case, if you reverse engineer it, well, congratulations, you've broken their trade secret. They can't
right.
protect their trade secret.
Actually, one thing about the Z Corps that when you load up their software, it says in little small print, if you're not using our materials, then we don't license our patents to you. Which to me seems like something that I'd like to see them try to enforce that. Oh, you put the wrong powder in this machine, so we're going to charge you with infringing our patents.
It's been done. Technically, they have the right to do that. Mm-hmm. By giving you an ongoing license, they're giving you mm-hmm. something in exchange, and they can put whatever requirement that they want on that license. Question.
You may have partly answered the question there, but it was in the example that was given. Let's say we have somebody who's created a transmission complete with gearing and everything, but as an individual I come along and come with an alternate set of gears as a replacement. Is that an infringement?
No. And that's what you have to do. Is each patent, you know, just is going to talk about this, that, and the other, and there's all these different ways that you could implement my grand idea, but at the end of it are these sets of claims, which can be terribly complicated. They can be very simple. But those claims are what a court is going to interpret as far as whether or not you are practicing the invention. In the end, you say, what I claim is a set of gears comprising one gear having this ratio to this ratio or what have you. And the court is going to interpret that and decide whether your invention is that or whether it's an improvement or it's different or it's not the same. And if it's not the same, you're not infringing. But if it is the same, you have infringement. If it's an improvement, which is to say it's different, if it's different from what is claimed, it might not be an improvement. It might be a disaster, but you know, you still won't be infringing if it's different from what is claimed.
And one thing that's sort of going to be interesting with this technology, this is rapid prototyping.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of prototyping, you think of guys in a lab designing something and testing. It's their own designs. But we're moving this by having these desktop machines at home into rapid manufacturing. And one of the things about this whistle was someone designed the whistle and they uploaded it to Thingiverse,
mm-hmm.
and someone in Germany printed it out less than an hour later. So what's the fastest way to get a whistle from the U.S. to Germany? The answer is a 3D printer. But, you know, it's going to get back down into the same stuff that Napster went through, where physical designs, where now instead of going to Walmart and buying something, you can just go home and print it out. Or someone with a 3D scanner can scan a physical object and
absolutely
send it around.
If you think we've had copyright arguments now with music, you wait until the toy industry is selling licenses to print your toys at home.
Because their patents are not nearly as vague as software patents.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I mean we're talking copyright and design, you know,
and trademarks and everything else.
Yeah,
we got a question regarding trademarks. As an example, I can think of easily. Let's say I have a console, a gaming console at home, and the case breaks.
Mm-hmm.
So I design a replacement with all the logoing and everything else on it, and put it on Thingiverse. How does that get enforced? Is that going to be
that is a patent? No, that'll be trademark infringement.
The question, though, is who would be infringing? Would it be just the designer, or would it be everyone who prints a replacement?
Yes. the designer would be on the hook for contributing to the infringement, and the people who actually did it would be on the hook for actual infringement. Now, here's the
there could be fair use,
that copyright, not for trademarks, not if he's putting the company logo on the box.
As long as nobody has any reasonable expectation that you're claiming to be the owner of the trademark.
Okay, you tell Sony that. No,
it's a parody. It's a parody.
Yeah. No, but that's an interesting point, though, because even if, say, Sony has a design patent on the shape of the PlayStation 3 box and the console cracks and you make a new piece to repair it, by selling you that device, you have the right to repair your stuff. And if you make replacement parts to repair someone's stuff, then you are not necessarily infringing their patents, even if it's a design patent, or not really even infringing their copyright. You have the right to make those repairs.
But can he sell those pieces? Or upload them to Thingiverse? Or is that where it gets hairy?
It gets a little hairy. Generally, you have the right to repair your own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at what point is it, okay, I'm making this to repair my friend's stuff, versus I'm making this to sell to people. Generally, courts have been pretty reasonable about the repair doctrine. If you are not trying to put their logos on it and infringe their trademarks, not trying to make it seem like it's a replacement part from that company, and you're selling just, you know, it's the same as with a car part. You don't necessarily have to go to Ford to get that new fender. You can go to a metal shop and have them make you a new one. It's when you start rebuilding the entire thing, when you start trying to say this is a Sony part using their trademarks, that you get into trouble.
The guy in the back's had the microphone.
Yeah.
Say I have a video game and I pull a 3D model out of that and I convert it into like an STL file and then I print that off. Is there any, what are the implications of something like that?
Ooh.
Did you say a video game like character?
Yeah, a video game character.
Or a sprite.
Yeah. You could have both copyright and trademark infringement there, because someone owns that intellectual property. You know, Microsoft Studios or Bungie or whoever owns the Master Chief image.
Kind of like this.
Yeah, something like that. although I think the Space Invaders are probably safe at this point. Yeah. It may not be public domain, but I doubt they're enforcing that trademark very heavily. They'd probably just glad anyone's still paying them any attention.
What about the IP status of the pattern files themselves? Would they be coverable under a software patent, or would it be treated more like a sewing pattern, or what?
Actually, I think that's one of the neatest questions that occurred to me while I was getting ready for this panel. I don't know how those would be protected. Generally, software in general in this country is kind of a question how you protect it. I mean, we've got lots of software patents that are sometimes enforceable, and we've got lots of copyright about software that's sometimes enforceable. For designs, it's generally going to be a copyright, I would think. You might also have a design patent, since you've got a physical object. A design patent is different from what we usually think of in patents, because it's just the visual appearance of the object. I mean, Google has a design patent on their homepage, which is Google search box search. I'm feeling lucky. You can have a design patent on the visual appearance of anything, as long as it's new. It's much more like a copyright than a patent per se. But a design file, the functional elements cannot be protected under copyright. So like the specific instructions to the printer, the machine code, the object code is not necessarily protectable. But because it has an end result that's a physical object with design and artistic merit, is kind of the legal term for it, it could be protectable under copyright. And certainly there's a large range of software patentable software in the libraries that they're talking about for converting this to the printer code.
Is there a difference if he looks at this character, models it himself, and then prints it out versus ripping the model out of the game?
Yes. I mean, it's the same from a copyright or trademark perspective as if you start going out and selling Superman comics. Mm-hmm. It's their character. They own that intellectual property.
What happens when you have the instance of you print a model of your Second Life apartment, which to some extent how it's put together and represented is up to you, but you didn't write the code that actually generated the image on the screen. Where does it fall with that?
That gets tricky with Second Life's particular brand of user ownership because they do not necessarily claim intellectual property rights in the renderings in the world. You would probably be okay in terms of dealing with Linden Labs, but if you go and you buy other people's models that you use to decorate your apartment, they might have a problem with you reselling their work because the rights to each of those models remain with the creators in Second Life, which is just going to be a nightmare if people start doing that because you got to deal with umpteen different people.
Are there standards for or definitions for how much something has to be changed before it's considered to be not the same? So, for instance, if you took something like those characters, if somebody puts something as a model and you, say, scale it up by 0.01%, have you changed it? If you take it and distort it, things like that,
Well, it kind of depends. For something like going back to, like, the Master Chief model, if it's recognizable as the character from Halo, you're infringing the trademark. You can't just make it a different size or put him in a pink uniform or
whatever. What if it's a character that looks a lot like Master Chief from Halo?
That's the thing. I mean, if you're the more you try and put it in a setting that it's clearly, I mean, if he's fighting some strange aliens on a ring world, you're probably going to be in trouble. If he's dating Barbie, you're probably going to be okay. Well, except Marvel's going to, Mattel's going to come after you then.
A lot of these questions seem to be targeted to, personal use situation, which seems to me, maybe technically you might be violating intellectual property law, but I mean, so is a kid scrawling Superman on a record
tape.
How do they enforce it?
I think this is something I want to mention too. This is gonna, I predict, become a big issue in about 3 or 4 years. Once HP makes a printer like this, right, and you can buy this stuff at Walmart, this has vast effects on the economy, right? I mean, you're not gonna get cheap McDonald's toys or things like that. You may not need to go to Toys R Us to buy Legos if you can print them at home. So
especially
once,
with 3D scanning.
Yeah, once it's going to become a big issue.
Absolutely.
Because
with a 3D printer now.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
I mean,
to actually replicate
and
objects.
I think that I think sites like Thingiverse are good because it'll be easy to prove prior art in some of these designs.
True.
and when they're GPL'd early and published early, but it's got potential to drastically affect the economy, and maybe not in a way that's good for the economy. It'd probably be good for consumers.
Oh yeah.
But in terms of industry as a whole.
Well, I think we'll see a lot of consolidation of industry. There will be a lot more. There will be a big move back to raw material instead of finished product, obviously. We'll see. The first thing that's going to happen is someone is going to sue HP for creating the device to enable them to to infringe copyright. It happened to Sony. It happens to everyone who does it.
Unless that company happens to be Chinese.
Well...
Good luck suing the Chinese
sued,
for IP.
Yeah, good luck. But that doesn't mean they're not going to try and block the import of these things.
Yeah.
It's a bottle opener.
And that's the great thing about the Mendel. They can't really stop it because you can make one yourself.
Sure.
It is literally just a design. Yeah. There is no manufacturing.
Well, what is going to happen when somebody uploads the model for a working gun?
Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah, that box would be a little difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
one thing about Thingiverse, it's not just 3D printed models.
Yeah.
You can design things out of sheet metal and upload them to Thingiverse, and so there's no reason you couldn't. Actually, do they have a non-weapons policy?
As far, I haven't read their non-weapons
policy. Someone told
policy,
me that Thingiverse has a non-weapons policy, but I don't know.
I think that just depends on how...
I mean, they've got a catapult.
Yeah.
And brass knuckles.
Yeah, I've seen brass knuckles on there before.
Depends on the state, but it is legal to make your own firearms for personal use, at least in Georgia and most states.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out, Thingiverse is not just 3D models. It's laser-cut stuff and just general ideas for designs. It's kind of cool like that.
Yeah, whether or not someone goes after them, the person who uploaded the model for enabling... violence against children, what have you. Yeah.
If a five-year-old knows how to use a 3D printer, then that means we've advanced this technology significantly, and I'd be very happy.
There's been a move towards 3D printing of organs. Do any of you know anything about that?
Yes.
I've actually, the Z-Corp printer is actually one of the things that was used for that. So what they did was instead of this plaster powder, they used sugar, which is one of the materials I can use to print on that doesn't cost $700 for 5 gallons. But as a binder, they used this, basically they mix a sugar and some cells from the human body and use a nutrient slurry as the binder, and basically they could literally grow implantable parts. That's really revolutionary technology. That's amazing.
Using a person's own cells.
And there's no rejection because they print it out of your own cells.
And of course, as with any new technology, the porn industry is leading the way. And there have already been
since
some...
Since you mentioned that, one of the first things people ask when you say, I have a 3D printer, is, can you make me a toy?
Uh-huh.
And my response is always...
That says a lot about your friends.
My response is always that it's a lot cheaper to mold and cast. Why would I design a 3D? So yeah, that's the thing about this technology is it's not just 3D printing. I mean, I can buy a toy at Toys R Us, mold it, and make lots of copies. And that's just, it's the same kind of violation as it is if I 3D print it.
But with some of these things, there is actual protection for people's characteristics, their faces, other parts that have been molded. This has actually come up in this context.
There's a lot of people that have posted 3D scans of their face onto Thingiverse.
I'm glad you said face.
Well, there's somebody regulating this site. They seem to keep it.
So if they do, going back to this guy's point about them making weapons, are we going to see an arms race between the Mendel and the MakerBot?
Actually, the Mendel is sort of, it's a derivative of the MakerBot. Basically, the Mendel, the idea, or the MakerBot is a derivative of the Mendel. The idea with the MakerBot was, well, let's make something that's simpler, and instead of trying to be able to recreate itself, let's just make something simpler out of the same components. The extruder is actually was a RepRap extruder that they started with.
It's worth pointing out, too, that these two actually very much collaborate. If you go in, you look in their code repositories, a lot of people that work for MakerBot have submitted, in fact, most of the current electronics design for the Mendel were done by MakerBot people. So they're not just taking what's been done and, for example, making something and selling it. They're actually, it's a real open source community, and these two play nice. They do contribute back and forth, and they're honestly kind of going at different markets. So, and most people that build a Mendel buy a MakerBot to do it. So.
And you can actually download the designs for the MakerBot, and if you have a laser cutter, you can cut them yourself, and you can even sell MakerBots if you want to.
Yep.
And that's actually one part that sort of worries me is when someone comes after MakerBot for patent infringement.
You could laser cut the entire MakerBot kit and sell it. You can't brand it, though. They're very specific about that. You can't trade.
Right. You can't sell it as a MakerBot?
No. Yeah, and there's companies that sell upgrades like MakerGear.com, and they can't use the MakerBot name. But like the extruder that's owned there is not a MakerBot extruder. There's probably hundreds of companies at this point that sell upgraded parts that are usually just like a machinist that started selling stuff on eBay or online.
Bits from Bytes has one.
Wait, in the back.
I know we're kind of driving it into the ground, but with weapons, for example, let's take this forward 10 years, 15 years. We get to the point that there are sites like this where, you know, you just know you can go out there. It's almost like a text file or a zip file. You click on it, it's going to print. What if we get to the point where it's going to make a gun, or it's going to make that deadly sharp knife that the 5-year-old eventually uses in some terrible way? At what point does this become distribution instead of just, you know, being information that's being interpreted into the printer? When is it just so simple that you're practically selling the item itself?
Well, the second part of your question there is actually more interesting to me, of selling the item. Because everything in Thingiverse is free, but there's nothing to prevent you. And one of the ideas I had at first was to build this MakerBot into a kiosk. So where you can go into a mall and you can pay $10 and it'll print whatever you want out of ABS plastic. And so it will become that, but at the same time, it's just like the Anarchist Cookbook. A knife design is no different than the Anarchist Cookbook that tells you how to make bombs. And guess what? You can go to Barnes & Noble and you can buy the Anarchist Cookbook.
And much as how the porn industry leads the way, the government will lag 10 years behind in trying to regulate it.
And then they'll overreact.
And it'll take probably another 10 years before we come to...
Once there's serious lobby money, like once you can buy one of these to put on your desktop, I mean, there's going to be a lot of people worried about how this is going to change their business.
But to a certain point, they're not going to get around to it until the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, totally.
Go ahead. We seem to be thinking that printing things yourself is cheaper than buying them, but, you know, there's mass production efficiencies. I mean, Legos. Why would I print my own Legos when it's got to be cheaper to buy them when they're made by the millions?
Well, part of the difference is it's cheaper to manufacture them in the millions, but then they have to be put on a truck and trucked to wherever you buy them from, and then you have to drive there to pick them up. Mm-hmm. And it's also instant.
Pay retail markup.
Yeah, it's also semi-instant gratification.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to drive to the store. You just, oops, I broke a shower ring. There's a shower ring on Thingiverse, you know. I can replace it in 20 minutes. You know, no trip to the store. So there, even if it is not necessarily cheaper, there's a huge convenience factor. But with Legos, for example, if you're a Lego collector, you got to buy the big kit to get that one little part you need, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's also cheaper on lower scale. Like when you've got mass production, when you're trying to actually build millions of parts, then yes, it's going to be less expensive to do it with your traditional manufacturing avenues. But when you're just trying to create one of those parts, it's going to be much cheaper for you to actually print it out yourself, because you pay, for instance, I pay 3.5 cents per gram of plastic, and most objects take, you know, 10 or 12 grams of plastic, so it's, you know, less than a dollar for almost anything I print. And when you're talking about things that are, you know, odd objects that you would have to go to a machinist to build otherwise, you're going to come out much cheaper using a 3D printer than you would something like going to a machinist to build one part.
Yeah, cheap mold for injection molding is like 30 grand. Yeah. So that's a cheap one. So
I think we got time for about one more question. Is that all right? He's had his hand up for a minute.
It's all right. I like to have these really annoying questions. So here's the big one that I have about the protection of the open source of these devices. Blake said that you can't... You know, you can license a patent, but who has the patent for the Mendel and things like that? What's preventing some corporation from going, oh, this is fantastic, I'm going to just use this and patent it, or the actual patent holder of this to just retract and say, oh, thanks everyone, it's mine now, too bad.
I'm going to get him to back me up on this. They could file a patent and do that, but the glory of open source and Thingiverse and having it published is that it's so easy to prove prior art that the patent would be like...
Yeah, at this point, it's worthless. You could not patent this device.
But Stratasys probably has patents that would cover this device if I were to just guess.
I've heard that most of them expired, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Cool. I'm going to plug Freeside one more time.
We do have a giveaway.
Oh, we have yes, when we have.
So I was going to ask anyone who could remember what the name of the hackerspace in Atlanta was.
What is it?
and you have to have a dime.
Penny, that one.
Because this one's actually
a penny or a dime.
This is a printed bottle opener. Quite
so
convenient.
So first person with a penny or a dime.
Come
on. All right, come on up.
Come on up. So
you have a 1 to 10 cent bottle opener.
And again, we'll plug Freeside. It's if you live in Atlanta, it's a hackerspace. You want to learn how to weld, use a lathe.
Just put it in there. Put it in the slot.
You know, build one of these printers. anything like that. We do classes on electronics, circuit design.
Show how that works. This is
programming.
This is a bottle opener from Thingiverse that he just printed, and you stick a coin in there, and you can open your bottles with it. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, we have Freeside flyers up here. Feel free to take a closer look at the bots up here.